Yourself with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adrian. Welcome to the 63rd episode of Robots. In today's show, we'll be talking about flying robots with Chris Anderson, founder of DIY Drones, which is now the largest amateur UAV community in the world, and one of the largest robotics communities. Their goal is to help you build your own flying wing, quadrotor, or blimp from scratch.
We'll then tell you about some of the awesome ideas of robotic characters our listeners have had for the future Futurama episodes. But first, as always, let's listen to the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Following the recent announcement of an advanced humanoid robot developed by the University of Tehran's Advanced Vehicle Center in Iran, this week Turkey has officially unveiled their Surelp humanoid robot. Developed during an 8-year research effort, the robot can perform basic motions such as walking forwards and backwards or picking up and throwing away trash. While it may not be the most advanced humanoid, it shows how much the field has progressed since Honda began development of its Asimo in the late 1980s. With active humanoid research programs in the Far East, Europe, the USA, and now the Middle East, robotics has transformed into a truly global effort which should open the door to a wealth of new and diverse ideas. Californian company Berkeley Bionics, which some of you may remember for the Human Universal Load Carrier Exoskeleton, or HULK, has now unveiled their second exoskeleton called E-Legs. Unlike the HULK, which is aimed at increasing the strength and endurance of soldiers, their E-Leg system is aimed at allowing paralyzed patients to stand up and walk again. The system consists of a pair of metal legs that attach to the outside of a patient's legs using Velcro strips, a backpack containing a battery pack, and two crutches which help the patient balance and simultaneously act as the exoskeleton's control system. At 45 pounds or roughly 20 kilograms, the complete system is comparably lightweight. Nevertheless, Berkeley Bionics website lists an autonomy of over 6 hours under normal usage in a rehabilitation setting. The company is currently preparing its E-Leg system for clinical testing and will open enrollment for a medically supervised E-Legs gait training program in the second half of 2011. For more information on Turkey's Surelp humanoid robot and the new exoskeleton called E-Legs, visit our forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Thanks, Christine. Chris Anderson is editor-in-chief of the very well-known magazine Wired. In his free time, he discovered a passion for making flying robots with his son and launched the internet blog DIY Drones, which now has nearly 12,000 members and about 1 million page views per month. The goal of the blog is to give you all the necessary tools to build your own flying robots in a low-cost, safe, and easy way. They have a development team of more than 100 active developers contributing to about a dozen projects, both hardware and software. One of their products, the Ardu Pilot Autopilots, can be strapped on your flyers for autonomous control. In a rather new twist in the industry, DIY Drones focuses on making open-source hardware.
Hi, Chris. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, thanks.
Can you please present yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, I'm by day, I'm the editor of Wired magazine, and by night, I run an amateur UAV community at DIY Drones and a company called 3D Robotics that develops open-source autopilots.
What is DIY Drones?
DIY Drones started about 3 years ago as just a kind of a lark on my part. I had, I'm not a roboticist by training, but had been given a Lego Mindstorms kit And I have got a bunch of kids. And I'd also been given a radio control airplane. And we sort of built the Lego Mindstorms as, you know, according to the instructions with the kids, and they were like kind of mildly interested. And then we went to the park and flew the airplane and crashed it. And, you know, I was sort of thinking of my failings as a father in sort of getting either one of these to work right. And it suddenly occurred to me that maybe something more interesting, you know, than just following the instructions of Lego Mindstorms or crashing airplanes would be to have the Lego Mindstorms fly the airplane. And so I, you know, came back from my run and sat down at the dining room table with my 9-year-old and sort of, you know, imagined what a Lego autopilot would look like and how it would work. And, you know, it kind of almost slightly worked. And we kind of put it in a plane and we kind of got it to basically, you know, turn left and turn right on, you know, automatically and almost kind of fly itself. And that I suddenly realized that, you know, that the basically the democratization of the technology, that the arrival of sensors that were really cheap and easy to use, accelerometers, gyros, GPS, pressure sensors, things like that, you know, is now so they're so available even in cell phones that the notion of autopilots and autonomy was within the reach of everybody, including children. And on the basis of that, I just kind of started posting, thinking out loud and posting you know, some ideas and concepts and my sort of exploration. And this turned, I decided, you know, because I'm a, you know, a media guy by day, I tend to do these things in public. And I figure if I'm going to do something, I might as well try to, you know, do it with other people and create a community. And so we just decided to, so I just decided to start a site on a social network called, a platform called Ning. And that site was DIY Drones. And then, you know, as often happens, people kind of gravitated towards it. And now it's quite a big community, a social network with coming up on 12,000 members and a million page views a month.
12,000 members. Who are these people?
Well, yes, they are everybody and anybody. You know, we actually get, you know, they to become a member, you know, so you don't have to become a member to visit the site and read what's going on, but to contribute, you have to sign up. And so we, you know, it's all free, but we do ask, you know, for an email address and a little bit of biographical information. They range from, researchers, academics, students, a lot of students, especially engineering students. There's a lot of hobbyists, but broadly they're coming in two classes. They are kind of robotics people who want to explore the third dimension, who want to kind of get off the ground and into the air. And also to some extent, you know, just outdoor robotics, rovers and underwater as well, but mostly the air. And then they are, you know, radio control hobbyists, model airplane folks who want to kind of get to the next level of sophistication and, you know, introduce autonomy into their sport. So, you know, so some of the people are plane people who are learning about robotics, and some of them are robotics people learning about planes.
So someone who's never made a flying robot, what would you tell him to start with?
Yeah, we get this a lot. So basically we are for people who, you know, really, you know, we're trying to make life easy for people who don't necessarily have a lot of experience or knowledge in any of this, and we make it cheap and relatively accessible. So what we propose, what we suggest for people is that they start with a something called an Easy Star, which is a foam airplane, costs about $100, and it's pretty indestructible. You can crash it a lot, and we can vouch for that. We do in fact crash it a lot, and then, you know, this is just a kind of a radio control plane. It's a good way to, you know, to learn how to fly. But then we have a autopilot called ArduPilot, which is built on the Arduino open source embedded computing platform. And, you know, this is basically, you know, A, learn how to fly a plane, B, replace, you know, or insert an autopilot, and let the autopilot fly the plane. And initially, you let the autopilot just sort of help you fly with stabilization. And, you know, with, you can let go of the sticks and it'll kind of return to level flight. And then you add waypoints, and then you add things like automatic takeoff and landing, and then you add sort of loiters and, you know, image control things. And you get pretty sophisticated pretty quickly using, you know, basically a couple hundred dollars worth of electronics added onto a toy airplane.
That's interesting. It sounds so easy when you say it, but I know that it's not so easy to do. Is this something where you can really strap the autopilot on it and it's already pre-programmed to help you get started with already some functionalities, or do you really have to dive in and and learn how to program these autopilots?
Well, you certainly don't need to learn how to program, but there's no such thing as a you know, kind of a shrink-wrapped autopilot. Even the kind of the pro autopilots that cost tens of thousands of dollars need a lot of configuration. And the reason is that, you know, at the stage of, and I know you guys do a lot of this work as well, at this stage of autopilot development, you still kind of have to customize an autopilot for the plane, which is to say, you need to tell it a little bit about the aerodynamics of the plane, a little bit about your radio control setup, and then you have, you know, various other, you know, configurations involving how you want to use it. So what the way it works with ours, and we have a number of autopilot projects, including quads and IMUs and basic inertial measurement unit types, which are quite sophisticated, and much more simpler ones that use IR sensors, infrared sensors. But what we typically suggest is that people, you buy the autopilot, which is printed circuit board with some electronics on, and you sort of put it together, and that's, you know, takes about an hour. And then what you do is you load the code. And when you load the code, you're not really programming, you're just downloading some code and using the Arduino software to load it onto the board. And in the course of loading this, you need to sort of tell a little bit about your plane. And in the case of an EasyStar, I think that, you know, the basic settings, the default settings are all fine. And at that point, you can put it in the air and you can try, you just turn it on with a little toggle switch on your radio control, transmitter. You turn it on into like stabilization mode and you sort of confirm that it does in fact fly the plane by itself. And that, once that works, then you bring it to, they land it, and then you use a kind of a point and click desktop utility to add waypoints and kind of give it a mission. And then you put it back up in the air, and this time you switch into the third toggle position on your transmitter, and that would be auto, and it should fly a mission. In other words, it should, with the hands off, go and do what you told it to do, hit certain waypoints, loiter, come back home, fly to various altitudes, etc. Now, in truth, that's, usually most airframes require a little more tweaking than that, and there's, we can't always predict what motor you've used and, what changes you've made to the plane and, what kind of particular, radio control setup you have. So there's it doesn't always work that way. But, at this point, it's getting to the point that, that's our whole effort, is to make life easier for people trying to get into this this field. It's cheaper, a couple hundred dollars versus thousands of dollars. We use things like the Arduino system, which is designed to be used by artists and creative folks, not just programmers. The code's already written, and the instructions are hopefully pretty clear. And our whole effort is to make this accessible to the next category of people who would like to get into aerial robotics, but neither have the money nor the technical background to do it the traditional way.
You mentioned that sometimes there's crashes. What are the legal aspects of this? So what are people allowed to do with their robots?
Yeah, so every country has different rules. I'll just tell you the rules here in the United States, which are pretty close to the rules in most of Europe. And that is that as amateurs, we are really focused on amateurs. That is, people who are doing it flying for non-commercial reasons. They are flying mostly under radio control airplane exemptions, which is to say that they fly under 400 feet. They fly within visual line of sight, which is sort of like about a half mile in each direction. They stay away from built-up areas. And there's always the capacity to regain manual control. And so basically, it's treated like a radio-controlled airplane that flies below the altitude that would interfere with manned aircraft. Now that's safe, and at least when it comes to interfering with other aviation, it doesn't mean you won't crash, and it all doesn't mean that people couldn't get hurt. And so we advise people to do the normal thing, which is fly away from people. Typical aircraft flying fields or model aircraft flying fields are a good choice. And but these planes are very light. They're foam. They weigh, as maybe a couple kilograms, they're quite, the wingspans are maybe 3 or 4 feet. And so, if they do crash, they tend not to do any damage. They sometimes, if you choose well, they don't even do much damage to themselves. And the reason they crash is that, that first of all, you are in manual mode sometimes. And so, pilot error can cause a crash. And then all the other reasons, and, you'd be software error, hardware error, hookup error, wireless problems. This is still an immature technology in many ways, UAVs and especially open source UAVs. And so there's lots of things. It's also a relatively complicated, technology with lots of, electronic elements and code elements that can go wrong. And then, the real world introduces all sorts of things you can't anticipate, such as, winds of various sorts, GPS dropouts, things like that. So with all those things, crashes happen. And that's why manual control, the ability to switch back into manual control, is such an important element of this, which is that this stage of development, you always want a pilot able to take over. And so we don't recommend that people send their UAVs off on some mission outside of the line of sight and just hope it comes back. That's the kind of thing that's going to get us in trouble.
So at DIY Drones, you have around 100 developers working on hardware and software of all sorts. What type of products are coming out of DIY Drones?
DIY Drones is a community of people who are interested in amateur aerial robotics of all sorts. It also is the focus of several projects that are that recruit their members from out of this community. My projects and the projects that I'm involved in are all around the Arduino open source physical computing platform, and we pretty much want to kind of cover the ground. We have our first project was ArduPilot, which was a Arduino-based autopilot that uses thermopiles, which are infrared sensors. Then most recently, we've launched ArduPilot Mega, which is a full IMU, inertial measurement unit, autopilot, which uses gyros and accelerometers. And it's really quite sophisticated. It's kind of, roughly comparable with the, commercial autopilots. The hardware is out and the software is out in alpha right now, and that'll be out in a public beta within a week or two, by the end of September. And that's that is kind of our flagship product. Then we have ArduCopter, which is that same autopilot, but with a quadcopter frame. And that's designed to be sort of the cheapest quadcopter UAV on the market. And that'll be coming out also in probably mid-October, and that's pretty close to finished. And that's going to be huge. We sort of see the quadcopter market exploding, and this is there's really nothing out there at this sort of price range of a few hundred dollars that offers full autonomy like this. And then we do blimps as well with something called Blimpduino, which is a autonomous blimp or autonomous or RC controlled blimp that's also based on their Arduino project. And that's we actually sell a kit for less than $100 there. It's a great way for high school students to get involved in a really safe way. And we're thinking about rovers as well. So basically, if it involves Arduino and autonomous robotics and the outdoors of various sorts, GPS navigation and, true autonomy in a physically demanding environment, that's kind of where we go. There are also other projects. There's the UAV dev board from Bill Premerlani and his team. It's also grown out of our site. And all sorts of other smaller projects that some of which I don't even know about that are just happening between members on the site. But most of it right now is focused on the intersection of Arduino and robotics.
Do you have a full-time working team?
Well, we have the development team is mostly like any other open source project, volunteers. So most of these people have day jobs. Some of them in big companies you would have heard of, and some of them are really sophisticated, and some of them are just amateurs who picked it up on the fly. But most of it is volunteers working in their spare time. But we do have because this is hardware, not just software, hardware is different. You need to have manufacturing facilities. You need inventory. You need to, have a retail operation. So we actually have a company called 3D Robotics based in San Diego that has 5 employees, and we're now getting our second pick and place machine to do the electronics manufacturing. And so there is a kind of a full time business, creating the hardware that goes along with this. But the software side is done through mostly volunteer efforts.
So a lot of people have heard about open source software, but not so much open source hardware. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, open source hardware is relatively new, and there's about a dozen companies that are leading this right now. It's basically it's the notion that the social principles of open source software, which is to say, community collaboration and a kind of a philosophical commitment to free, both free as in speech and free as in beer, can work in hardware as well. But it's more complicated for a number of reasons. First of all, hardware has all these different elements. There's the printed circuit boards, schematic. There's the board design itself. There's the firmware. Then there's the software. There's the instructions. There's the bill of materials. All the components that go into it. And every one of these has a kind of a different. What does free mean? What does open source mean when you're talking about a bill of materials? What is it? What does it mean when you're talking about a schematic? What's the right format? What really encourages reuse and derivative designs, which you want to encourage? And so, sometimes the licenses used in software like the GPL work, and other times they really don't. They don't apply. And so I'm part of a committee that's trying to define open source hardware licenses in a way that really do sort of recommend a best practice that it fulfills the commitment towards openness, but in using standards and techniques that make it easy for people to use derivative designs. So, for example, a PDF of a schematic is not as useful as an Eagle file, which is this sort of printed circuit board design software. And the Eagle file is really easy to use if you just download it and you can start making derivatives. You don't have to reverse engineer it. So all these are seven layers of hardware, where there's just one layer or possibly two layers if you include documentation for software. And then there's the economics, which is to say that with hardware, if you really want to put this in the hands, get this in the hands of regular folks, you need to have the boards available for purchase at a reasonable price, and that means typically you need to buy huge amounts of components at to get volume discounts, which means you need funding, which means you need inventory, which means that typically you need a commercial model. So all of the open source hardware companies, including Arduino, and others include MakerBot and Spark Funds products, Adafruit, Bug Labs, and there's a few others. All of them are for-profit companies, which is considered sort of scandalous by some in the open source software world that these companies would be seeking to make a profit. And yet when you realize that open source hardware is so much more expensive to do properly, it turns out to be absolutely essential.
It sounds a bit risky as well from a commercial point of view, because it takes so much time to develop this hardware and it could potentially be reused by other industries.
Yeah, people again look at that and they say, you don't license, you don't patent your stuff, you don't license under terms that require royalties. You actually would let people take your ideas and sell a product that would compete? And the answer is yes, absolutely. Our notion that, the reason we license all of our technology, and by the way, all of our intellectual property is free and available to everybody, and you can, and it's all the terms allow commercial reuse. So we very much want to encourage people to take our technology and produce products in the marketplace that, potentially compete with us. And the reason we do that is that, first of all, our main aim is to get the technology out there and in more hands at lower prices. And so if some Chinese company wants to, can make our boards as well as we can at a cheaper price, that's terrific. That's the marketplace wins, and we'll move on and make something that that the marketplace is not making. Secondly, if they if someone were to make the same product at the same price, we feel pretty confident that we would continue to maintain market share, simply because the community is as important as the product. And if you buy a product from you know, from the people who created the product and the community that created the product, there is, you know you're going to be getting, you know, support. You know that it's going to be the leading edge of development. You know that you're sort of plugged into the heart of this product, and you always have the latest, greatest version. So we feel that community is a great competitive advantage, and that we're not too much concerned about price competition or derivative designs that don't add a lot of value undermining our market share, because we feel that in some sense our community is what people are really buying, and the price is less important. That said, if people do make derivative designs that do add value, in other words, versions that we never thought of or real improvements over our design, we would not only be delighted about that, but we may, because it's open source, those have to be open as well. And we may, ask to make their product, again, for the sake of the community, to make sure that the best product gets into the hands of the most people at the lowest price.
Drones are often seen as negative by the public because of the military applications. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I agree, and this is the biggest problem in our world, is that people correlate drones with weapons because that's what they read about and hear about, and most UAVs are in fact being used in a military context right now. Our job, our ambition is to change the perception of UAVs and have people understand how much application utility they do have for civilian and peaceful uses. Right now, this is hard to do because the regulatory environment doesn't allow UAVs to be used for practical applications in most national airspace. So you can't go beyond line of sight or above certain altitudes, above certain weights. But that's not true in all countries, and so it is possible to have proofs of concept elsewhere. And also regulations are changing. Broadly, what we'd like to do is anticipate or accelerate the future of aviation. We all know that a generation from now, aerospace is going to be robotic, that it will not be unusual to see UAVs overhead doing regular things, whether it's, traffic cameras or aerial mapping or scientific sensing or who knows, delivery maybe. But how to get there and who's going to do it is still kind of an open question. So the first thing we want to do is make UAVs and aerial robotics technology available so cheaply and easily that we can train a generation of engineers on it, and make it easier for universities to include aerial robotics into engineering school curriculum, whether it's really simple, easy stuff indoors like blimps and quadcopters, or under safe conditions, outdoor stuff as well. That, I think, is going to put more people out there who are skilled at this and are thinking about the applications. And then the regulators, needless to say, have to find a way for small companies, universities, even large companies to put UAVs into the national airspace in a safe manner under, whatever restrictions they want, size, weight, altitude, certain geographic areas. At that point, I think, there'll be something that becomes the first common use of UAVs, in people's daily lives, and it might be the police and rescue services, things like search and rescue, or creating wireless hubs for, say, fires or forest fires. I mean, it might be police work, which would have its own sort of, slight. Big brotherish qualities, but you can see the utility as well. Or it might be something as simple as cargo aircraft. FedEx, in particular, has talked about, how much better air cargo would be if you didn't have pilots in the planes. And initially, I think they're talking about maybe flocks of aircraft where the lead aircraft is manned, but the following aircraft are unmanned and have a completely different design that's optimized for cargo and doesn't, for example, because most cargo aircraft are manned aircraft that don't have the seats in. But if you could redesign the aircraft with no pilot whatsoever, it would be maybe a flying wing or lifting body, and it would be a much more efficient design. And so, initially maybe you'd have, one, like, think of a train, for example. A regular train is basically, one manned, car followed by many unmanned cars. So the notion of humans leading machines is not unfamiliar, that, of course, is on a track. So once you put it in the air, you'd have to create something like a virtual track where software ensures that all that kind of, you know, complicated connecting and navigation between UAVs is taken care of. But that's, you know, that's clearly a useful civilian purpose. And if people can be assured that it's safe and, you know, all the usual precautions are in place, then I think you'll see that as kind of people will stop thinking about UAVs as you know, predator drones and start thinking about them instead as delivery trucks.
I obviously love all these applications. Do you think there's anything that can and should be done to make sure people don't go the opposite way, especially if it's open source?
Yeah, this comes up a lot. You know, as you know, so traditionally autopilots and you know, aerial, you know, this kind of aerial robotics technology has been classified as a weapon by many countries. You know, they started as cruise missile controllers and, you know, and military drones, and so a lot of them are export controlled. As an open source community, especially you know, a global one, we're not really covered by any of this. There's usually public domain exemptions to some of these export controls, and these are developed outside of, you know, outside of any one country. They're again sort of, you know, they kind of, they're developed in the cloud. So it's hard to regulate them, you know, the way traditional you know, military industrial products might be regulated in terms of export or certification. One of the consequences of this is that it's very hard to limit who gets access to this. And you know, there are members of the DIY drones community from countries that are on you know, some countries' watch lists. Our policy is, you know, people ask us a lot what we're doing to ensure that people don't use it for bad stuff. And the answer is there's almost nothing we can do to stop people, but we do really reinforce good practice, safe practice, responsible practice, both in terms of flying and in terms of use patterns. We don't discriminate against any country. We don't assume that just because, you know, you live in country X, and I won't name which country that might be, but your country X that is often sort of seen as a dangerous country, we don't assume that you're up to no good. Instead, we watch people's behavior and we push everything into the public, and we have worked really closely with regulators and military agencies, especially in the United States, to keep them appraised as to what's possible, what's being done. I think we've briefed, you know, everybody from the White House down to you know, down to the Air Force and Navy, and to say nothing of the CIA, FBI, and NSA, about what's going on here. You know, just so that they know what's possible, so they can do a better job of monitoring this. So we kind of feel like, you know, monitoring bad guys is not our job. Our job is to do everything in public so that the people whose job it is to monitor bad guys are better informed and will be both making sort of better regulatory decisions and also, you know, to whatever extent security, you know, issues are tapped, you know, are required, that the fact that we do it in public makes it easier for them to spot problems before they arise.
Okay, let's look at one of the results of this approach, the ArduPilot Mega, which is the one you'll be releasing in September. Can you give us some insight into what this autopilot can do?
Yeah, so this is our, you know, our kind of, you know, pro class autopilot, and you know, what is actually, the hardware is already out there. What we're going to be releasing in September, at the end of September, is the sort of public code. Right now, there is public code available to people, but we don't encourage you know, regular folks to use it because it's evolving quickly. But what we took is sort of the standard for commercial autopilots. You know, things like Micropilot, etc. And we said, okay, let's say that is kind of the level of performance that people expect and features. Let's now do that on an open source platform. So it's two boards. It's a computer board, which is based on Arduino, the Arduino Mega platform, and then there's an IMU board, which has you know, the usual gyros, accelerometers, pressure sensor, data logging, things like that, and what it can do is it has you know, the usual autopilot functions, that it has stabilization and navigation. So the IMU is, you know, that's basically sort of is the inner ear, if you will, to use the biological analogy, and its job is largely to figure out, you know, where you are in a three axes. So, you know, wears down. In the same way that your inner ear, as you're walking down the street, the inner ear of your in your head sort of establishes where, you know, where gravity is, where's the ground. And then, you know, another function of your brain figures out, well, where am I going? So, you know, you've got the inner loop and an outer loop. The inner loop says, you know, keep me upright. And the outer loop says, let's find, you know, let's take a right at the next corner and, you know, make our way through the city. That's the two functions of the autopilot. In a sense, the two functions of the two boards. You know, the IMU figures out where down is. And then the processor does the mission functions of waypoints, various commands at the waypoints, and we have a scripting language there you can either predefine the mission or send mission commands while it's in flight, and you know they involve the normal things you would want from a UAV, starting with simple waypoints and then. Things like loitering at a single waypoint, controlling the cameras, takeoff landing, repeating certain waypoints, maybe following topology. You know, we know what the ground level is at any point on the mission, so we can maintain a certain altitude above ground. And then you can add even greater logic, like having a camera. Or a video camera, follow a certain position on the ground and just track an object. So this is all sort of the normal scripting that you would use for a UAV. And but you don't need to start to use that from the start. It's if you want to do nothing more than just have the plane sort of fly by itself when you take your hands off the stick, or maybe get you out of trouble when you're diving to the ground, it'll do that. Or if you want to go fully autonomous missions, it'll do that too.
Do you interact with the robot mainly by scripting, or do you also have a graphical interface?
Oh yeah, when I say scripting, it's all graphical. The underlying language is a scripting language, but the interface is all point and click. We use Google Maps and built into our desktop software, and you sort of point and click, and you say click this. This will be waypoint one. This will be waypoint two, and then each waypoint has properties, and you can introduce. It's kind of a visual language where you basically have these various actions, and the first action maybe go to this waypoint. The second action would be pause, loiter here. The third action would be take a photograph. Then the next action would be go to a next waypoint. And this is all done by pointing and clicking on maps, by and large, or graphic interfaces.
Here's a bit of a silly question, but how is an autopilot for a quad rotor different from an autopilot for a fixed wing robot, for example?
It's a very good question, and the basic answer is that the physical hardware is very similar. It's actually the same hardware, just different slightly different software. The challenge is the difference between fixed wing, between planes and quad rotors, or any kind of rotary wing, is that planes are always moving forward, and because they're always moving forward, you can get directional information from the GPS. Here's a little bit of geeking out of the technology. The way IMUs work, and the really essential part of an autopilot is knowing where down is. You combine gyroscopes and accelerometers, and gyroscopes are very accurate in the short term, but they drift. So they tend to kind of become less accurate as time goes on. Maybe they'll drift by a few degrees a minute. Accelerometers, on the other hand, are very inaccurate in the short term. Any kind of motion generates noise, but they don't drift, and so that inaccuracy doesn't grow over time. So what you want to do is you have a sort of one that's right short term but wrong long term, and the other one's wrong short term and right long term, and then you want to you basically fuse the two sensors into a filter, a software filter, either a common filter, what we use, which is the directional cosine matrix developed by Bill Permalani. And software combines these two and gets a kind of a stable solution. There's one axis that cannot be corrected by the accelerometers, and that's yaw. That is, in other words, rotating sideways. What yaw is, turning left and right, because gravity doesn't work on that dimension, and so we need a third sensor to correct the drift in the yaw gyro. And when you're moving forward, the GPS will give you a directional vector, and that's great, and that can correct direct that drift. If you're stationary, as a quadcopter or helicopter often is, you need a different sensor, and we use a magnetometer, basically a compass, to correct that vector. So that's the only real significant difference between the two airframes.
You have such a large community. I'd love to have some anecdotes. So what are some of the craziest projects which have been done on DIY drones?
Oh, the craziest projects. Yeah, well, the really crazy projects we try to discourage, but the kind of interesting ones. Well, let's see. Some people from our community went to DEF CON, which is the hacker conference, and they came up with a aerial war driving bot, which is to say it's a UAV using Argipilot with a Wi-Fi sniffer. And I think this was largely a kind of a proof of concept rather than any practical application, but the idea was fly over houses, and right there you can see I'm starting to kind of sweat a little, but fly over houses, and if you detect an open Wi-Fi access point that's not locked down, loiter over that, and I guess if you were going to be naughty, you would intercept the signal and hack into the community, all that kind of naughty, hacker stuff. But more to the point, you could just be detecting vulnerable Wi-Fi access points and hopefully telling people to close down their access point. So this is a great kind of, a proof of concept, and that it's war driving is typically done when the car, but this would be done by a UAV. It's kind of an example of what you could do. On the more sort of, let's say, socially acceptable norms, there's Gary Mortimer out at the UK spends a lot of his time in Africa, and one of the functions there is wildlife management. They use UAVs to track wildlife herds and nesting, and it's a really good way to, because this is, again, robotics in general, but UAVs in particular are good for jobs that are dull, dirty, and dangerous. And, the idea of kind of watching wildlife for hours or days or even weeks is one of those jobs that could be kind of potentially dull, but it's really good for UAVs, but too expensive for manned aircraft. And so they've been doing nesting, looking at bird nesting. It's a great way, because these things are small and very quiet, it doesn't disturb the birds, and it's a great way to cover a lot of ground without a lot of cost.
Okay, let's have a look at the future now. Where do you see the future of DIY drones?
Well, the future of DIY drones is really tapped into the future of amateur UAVs, and this is it's exploding. We're pretty much doubling every 6 months at this point. The reason this is exploding is not so much because of us, but because of the Moore's law of sensors. Because the essential technologies for UAVs are now in your cell phone, gyros, accelerometers, GPS, processing, wireless connections, etc. This technology is getting super cheap, super easy to use, and as a result, the community who's sort of recognizing there's an opportunity to get involved in aero robotics is growing, as always happens with computing. Computers were once the mainframes and only available to the rich or the privileged. Now they're everywhere, and because they got cheap and easy, this happens. The democratization of technology is this kind of the huge driver of our time, and the fact that the day that it would come to aerial robotics was bound to come. What we're seeing is that as people like us take these ideas and kind of put them together and make them easier for people, the class of participants grows, and so we have high school students, we have retired people, we have people from around the world, and because it's so cheap to get into, and because it sort of starts with a model airplane, which so many people have experience with, you're starting to pull in people who never thought of themselves as roboticists at all, and some of them, like the model airplane enthusiasts, some of them don't want nothing more than to have their plane come back when they lose a radio connection. Some of them are into the so-called first-person view hobby, which is where you have a a wireless video camera on the plane, and you fly remotely with video goggles. One of the problems with that is that it's easy to get disoriented, and so just being able to flick a switch and have the plane come home by itself is really helpful. There's a ton of people who are just interested in robotics, but kind of bored by doing things inside and on the ground, and want to kind of take it out into the real world and do something more challenging. And so this is kind of emerging side of robotics hobbyists. And then there's just the notion that it's the cool new thing. And Arduino in particular, as a the notion of physical computing and open source hardware is exploding. And as people get more and more involved in sort of going from the abstract, fiddling with computers and software, to fiddling with computers and sensors and computers that can do things in the real world with actuators and sense and awareness of where they are, this has become the sort of exciting new domain for geeks everywhere. And aerial robotics is a great way to test it.
Excellent. One final question. What's your dream flying robot for the future?
This is the right question, because it is day in, day out, my main job is to make it easier, make aerial robotics and UAVs easier for people. And the biggest complexity right now is the out of the box experience, the fact that you have to set it up, the fact that every airframe is different. So the dream UAV, and when I say dream, this is very much on our roadmap, is one that teaches itself how to fly a plane. You basically, you open it up, you put it in your plane, you just, connect the wires, according to the instructions. You take off and fly the plane manually. And as you're flying the plane manually, the autopilot is learning about the plane, learning about the configuration. It's kind of figuring things out by itself. It's dynamically adapting. And at the end of a test flight, you do a couple circles, you take off, you land. At that point, it's trained. And, no configuration required. And that when that day comes, and it's really just a matter of software, when we can get that dynamic learning, working, then I think, we've reached the next class of users. And, now we're talking about people who don't have to know anything about programming, don't know have to use a soldering iron, don't have to know really anything about aircraft design or dynamics at all. They just want to, get a plane to fly autonomously. And, this is the way it's going to happen. At that point, you can then sort of stop thinking about the autopilot and start thinking about the mission and, what are you doing? And you move to the next level of utility, which is, what are UAVs good for? Scientific sensing, observation, when you think about it, the analogy to technology is kind of apt. We the technologists figured out TCP/IP and HTML and HTTP and all these kind of web functions. But regular folks figured out what it was for. In a sense, technologists created the infrastructure of the internet and the web, but the regular people figured out the utility and the sort of the contents and how to use it. And that was only possible because the technology became abstracted and kind of faded into the background. And the sooner we can take autonomy and robotics and all the kind of complexity of actually getting the plane to actually do things on its own, and just abstract that and push it into the background and black box it, the sooner people can think about the useful applications of UAVs. And I have no idea what the killer app of amateur UAVs is going to be, but I do know that I'm not going to think of it. All I can do is make the technology cheap, easy, and ubiquitous, and then this much larger community, if not tens of thousands, but maybe hundreds of thousands of people someday, will figure out what it's really good for.
Thanks, Chris, for being here with us on Robots.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
I'm sure you remember our last episode 2 weeks ago, where we interviewed David X. Cohen from Futurama. We asked you to come up with some cool robotic characters that you would like to see in this show. Well, we thought we'd share some of the ideas that came up on our forum. First up is a robot that can, of course, row boats, but up waterfalls. Then, answering machine robots that, unlike your usual answering machine, is a sophisticated humanoid that can pick up your ringing phone, hand it to you, and slam it down when your conversation turns unpleasant. Next up, a Turing robot that replies on a ticker tape in a geeky programming type of language. Now, here's another cool robot. Imagine you're sitting at a meeting with all your colleagues and here comes Outlook robot. Yes, Outlook as in Microsoft Outlook. The robot walks in and hands you letters for each email received, with physical attachments such as Polaroids literally paper-clipped to your letter. Another idea that came up is the blog bot that emulates the blogging habits of the usual teenager that has nothing to say. And last but not least, a robot hat. Imagine trying to wear a hat that tries to help you with mundane activities such as wiping your nose or cleaning your ears, although with the usual programming error.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Do It Yourself with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.